Hello there, you're with Extra with me, Geraldine Doogan. Of course, you're here on RN and I'm delighted to be back with you in this time slot in 2016, bringing you just some of the people and the stories that excite me each week as we compile the joys of Saturday Extra for your edification and delight. For now, though, here are two we recorded late last year. First to this question of, do we really get value for money from our defence spending? Do we even need the usual list that provokes all the headlines? There's been an ongoing discussion, as you'll know, within the last 12 months, since the government announced we'd be buying 58 F-35 Joint Strike Fighter jets for $12 billion. Then came that rather dramatic statement that $40 billion would be spent on building surface ships for the Navy in South Australia, and another $30 to $50 billion has been set aside for a fleet of up to 12 new submarines. We're not quite sure where they're to be built yet. But this submarine project has been called one of the biggest and most expensive infrastructure projects in Australian history, as ambitious as the Snowy Mountains Scheme or the NBN, whether or not many of us are fully connected with that. But Dr. Robin Olsen from Darwin has. There must be many more like myself, he says, who wonder about the need for them in the Australian Defence Force. Who are they going to protect us against? Could this warrant a few minutes on a Saturday morning? Well, yes, Robin, we think it could. Joining me now to discuss subs, why they've mattered and should they still, is a British naval historian, Dr. Duncan Redford, speaking to us from Portsmouth via Skype, along with Graham Dunk, an ex-submariner, now manager of a peak body called the Australian Defence Industry Group. Welcome to you both.
Geraldine, lovely to be here.
Graham, to start with you, you served in the RAN as an anti-submarine warfare officer. What does that mean? What did you do?
Basically, you go out on ships to look for submarines and counter them.
You write a very interesting blog, I suppose it is, where you talk about their valid role, questioning them, I think, in the future Australian force structure due to their, and I'm quoting you, ongoing ability to exert psychological pressure on an adversary, intelligence gathering, interdiction of shipping, and a range of other covert operations. This psychological pressure aspect, tell us about that.
Well, submarines, by their nature, are stealthy. That's what they're designed to do. They're designed to go out and not be seen. Therefore, for somebody who has submarines in their order of battle, the adversary, the opposing force, has to assume that pretty much wherever they go, there's likely to be a submarine there, whether they see them or not.
And do you think that makes them a vital part of a modern defence force or not?
Oh, definitely that makes them a vital part. It gives the government important strategic options, both in peacetime and, ever came to that, in wartime.
Even at the cost of $30 to $50 billion?
Oh, definitely. They're worth the money because of the actions that a potential adversary will have to take in order to counter them, to assume that they are going to be there and therefore able to work against you.
Plays with an adversary's mind and means that he, she, have to spend money, equal and opposite money, in order to counter.
Exactly right.
All right. Duncan, you were in the British Navy, and I'm just intrigued too about the sort of public conversations around submarines, because this is what you've tried to look at. How would you characterise the changing tone of that?
Well, first off, I think Graham's absolutely right. The submarine really does paralyse, particularly navies who aren't well equipped to deal with it. So that is a very important psychological advantage for anyone who has got submarines. The problem with the public discourse, you know, what we say about submarines, is that they often have been used in ways that people don't like, particularly in the First and Second World Wars, when they were used against civilian shipping, and the public really didn't like that, just in the same way that many people didn't like the idea of indiscriminate bombing from the air, and many people still don't. So the problem with submarines is that they're a very specialised form of technology, and in some ways it challenges some people's view about how warfare should be carried out. Those views have changed over time, I'm happy to say, and now the submarine is now viewed as an asset to navies, and one that will be able to do a wide range of tasks, intelligence gathering, anti-submarine warfare, anti-surface ship warfare, as well as special forces insertion, and the psychological warfare that Graham has already alluded to. debates over the size of the submarine force and the type of submarines that you have are very different to whether you should or should not have submarines in the first place as part of your Navy.
In the last part of our conversation, I'd like to talk about what is happening right now in the Pacific and Indian Oceans, because I read much, I was a complete surprise to me, I have to say, just how much submarines are coming into this region around us. But let's talk about submarines becoming nuclear, because I understand from your book, Duncan, that that's quite an important marker buoy of change.
Yes, it is. Nuclear propulsion really is a game changer for submarines, though other forms of technology with air-independent propulsion are starting to catch up. It's still not quite the same as having a nuclear reactor. It's different from having nuclear weapons. A nuclear reactor that gives you unlimited power for propulsion. It makes your submarine capable of travelling on a global scale, and it means that you do not have to come back to the surface at all if you don't want to. You can make your own oxygen out of seawater, which is something that takes a huge amount of electricity and something that is only really viable with a nuclear reactor to power it.
Are the majority or all of British submarines nuclear?
All British submarines now are nuclear powered, yes.
Nuclear powered. I think I'm right, Graham, we don't have nuclear subs, is that right?
No, we do not. All our submarines are conventional, that is, they're powered by batteries. But as Duncan alluded to, that means that periodically they need to come to the surface, they need to expose masts, they need to run diesel engines in order to repower the batteries. And that causes them to be vulnerable at that time for detection.
And the Collins class, I mean, I should know this, but I don't. What were they going to be conventionally powered?
They're conventionally powered, The future submarine will be a conventionally powered submarine.
Why aren't we considering nuclear subs?
Well, in order to have a nuclear submarine, we need to have a fairly robust and mature nuclear industry in country in order to be able to support them. And we don't have that. We don't have the nuclear engineers. We don't have the infrastructure.
You wrote recently that you thought the whole discussion around the follow-on submarine to the Collins class and the ones we're ordering had become a soap opera.
Yes, I
did. Why so?
It was really around the way in which the project was being addressed by the government. On one hand, the talk was all around a captain's pick, call it that, with Japan. And then there was the talk around suddenly a new acquisition process, the competitive evaluation process. And then there were a range of other issues.
It's just that because of what we've heard, you know, where stealth and sort of almost mystery is part of it all, it doesn't help necessarily, does it, to have a big mature, if we can even have one in this country, conversation around this particular class, does it?
Well, we need to have the mature conversation around why they are important and, as we are having now, why the large amounts of money are actually warranted.
Well, look, let's finish with just how many of them are around, because at a conference earlier this year, Graham, our Minister for Defence, Kevin Andrews, said that by 2030, approximately 300 submarines were expected to be operating in the Indo-Pacific region. Whose submarines will they be? And is this all part of a sort of geopolitical rivalry?
Well, it demonstrates the importance of submarines in to a variety of countries. And we do live in a archipelagic maritime environment that where conventional submarines are particularly useful. So the submarines are going to be operated from Japan, South Korea, China, Taiwan, Vietnam, Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, you keep going, Indonesia.
And they're all, in fact, he did say there's a sub-buying frenzy going on in the Asia-Pacific. Is that right?
Pretty much, yes.
And is that the case in the Northern Hemisphere, Duncan?
Unfortunately not. European defence budgets are under a lot of pressure at the moment. Britain is not in a position.
Yes, you're downgrading, aren't you? It's very interesting.
Unfortunately, yes, the Navy is getting smaller, the commitments and responsibilities aren't. And the Royal Navy is having to try to do more with less ships and submarines.
Are you still building subs, by the way? Like in this?
Yes, we're building a new class of hunter-killer submarines called the Astute class. The first couple are in service and the remainder are being built or waiting for a building slip to come available.
Right, so in this straitened times, that budgetary item is still allowed?
Well, yes. I mean, in some respects, it's more to do with infrastructure than military need. If we want to have submarines, we have to keep building them. Because if we stop building them, the people that make them for us will go and get other jobs. And so you lose the capability. And one of the concerns has been, how are we going to replace our current strategic missile submarines if we lose the capability to build submarines? So,
gosh, that almost makes them sound brittle, a brittle sort of item.
Well, the skills of the workforce are very brittle. If they're not used, they disappear. So rather than lose those skills, we needed more a new class of hunter-killer submarine to replace our aging existing fleet. So the decision was made to build these submarines, which would conveniently fill in the gap between the last of the Trident nuclear missile submarines being built in the early 90s and the emergence of a new successor to the Trident submarine sometime in the next 10, 15 years.
So that argument about, you know, if you don't use it, you'll lose it, the skills, I suppose that you think that's very pertinent.
No, it is. And you have to realise that submarines have been described as the second most complex thing to build after the International Space Station. So that provides a sort of the scope of the task and therefore the highly skilled workforce that is required to do this. So Duncan's point is valid. You know, if you don't use it, you'll lose it. The people will go elsewhere, and then you'll have to do what basically we're having to do now. If the submarines are built in Australia, which is still an option, we will have to build a workforce back up from pretty well nothing.
It's amidst this sort of almost like a regional arms race, some people suggest we're having. I notice, Graham, the former Chief of Army, Vice Admiral Ray Grigg, said in April, our subs provide us with strategic weight in a way that no other ADF asset does. That's a pretty big claim. Do you go with that?
I think it does. It provides you with, as I alluded to earlier, it provides the government with a vast array of strategic options in peacetime. It can go out and can do intelligence gathering and reconnaissance. In periods of tension, you can declare that you've deployed your submarine somewhere, even if you haven't, that people have to take note of it. And in wartime, you can deny parts of the environment to an enemy. That's whether you park your submarine off a base, whether you interdict shipping, whether you land special forces, and stealth provides the ability to do all these things. That's where the strategic weight comes from, and that's why that they're important.
Well, look, thank you very much indeed for that little snapshot of the, I suppose, the cultural meaning of subs and the way they're likely to be used. So, Graham Dunn, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure, Geraldine.
And Dr. Duncan Redford, thank you very much to you.
Oh, thank you very much for the invitation. It's been a pleasure.
I hardly think a week goes by without some anguished public effort to analyse why young Australians volunteer to fight beside jihadists in the Middle East. So it was natural, I suppose, that we'd receive suggestions from our listeners about how we might cover this differently. So we're going to try now. After all, about 150 Australians and dual nationals have left these shores to fight, especially in Iraq and Syria. The number worldwide's around 20,000, estimated by the International Centre of Radicalisation. Between 5 and 10% have been killed. About 7,000 are believed to have returned to their homes, which of course has become quite a debate here, with our Prime Minister suggesting the best thing we can do is ensure they don't come back. Other countries have taken a different approach. A listener called Mari alerted us to a Der Spiegel article about a Danish program run by the police there, of all people, in Aarhus, Denmark's second city. A program, as the report says, almost naive in its simplicity, essentially a vast screening program for potential terrorists. And the strange thing is, it seems to be working. Well, the person who devised this program is Alan Arslev. He's a superintendent with the East Jutland Police, and he joins us now to explain how the program operates. Superintendent, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you.
I take it that there's been a great deal of interest worldwide in this program of yours. Are you a bit surprised?
Not a bit surprised. We were surprised that this huge interest. For the past year, we have spoken to more than 300 international media.
Goodness me. And what is it that surprises them, if I can ask you that?
Well, I suspect that what is special about this program is the fact that all over the world, it is considered more or less that we are at war. And what we do here is not being at war. We talk to people and we try to discuss with them how we can solve this problem. We recognize it is very difficult to prosecute them. However, we suspect that some of them has committed crimes while they were in Syria. But we try to approach these persons. And of course, we are the police. If we could investigate these matters and prosecute them, we would do that. However, we also recognize the fact that even though they have committed some kind of crimes in Syria, it is important for us that they acts without committing any crimes when they return. So we try to approach them and talk to them about what they have been doing in Syria, and we try to get them back to some kind of normal life, education, work, and so on. And as a matter of fact, that is what is successful in this program, I think. The fact that we try to connect them and invite them to come back into the society, to the local society again.
Yeah, before we get into the details, how candid are they with you as they talk about what they've done in places like Syria and Iraq?
Well, according to the Danish legislation, it's not illegal in itself to go to Syria. What is illegal is to fight for the Islamic State, the Al-Qaeda or the Al-Nusra. If you fight for the Free Syrian Army, as a matter of fact, according to the Danish legislation, it is not illegal. And when we see people traveling to Syria, if they return and we have no kind of proof about what they have been doing in Syria, because it is very difficult for us to gather information about what they have been doing, we cannot be sure they tell us the whole story. So, as a matter of fact, some of them are candid and others aren't. We are not so naive, so we think they tell us the whole story, and we are quite convinced that some of the persons we speak to has been fighting for some of the illegal groups. However, if we can't prove it, we try to listen to what they say. We don't believe all they say, but we try to assess what kind of situation they're in and how we can deal with them when they are here back in Denmark.
I mean, you're a policeman. It's in your DNA to sort of try to test people, I suppose. I presume that you're hinting at the fact that you think you have had people sitting in front of you who may have real blood on their hands, and then you've got to assess whether they're going to represent a danger to Danish society. It's quite a responsibility.
Well, it is quite a responsibility. However, what we do here is not the only thing we do. Of course, we do the same things as I can see we do elsewhere in the world. We try to investigate, we try to surveil them, we try to gather intelligence. This is not a program that goes alone. It goes as something that could support the other things we do. So if I am mistaken about what I see when I speak to some of these young men, well, they might be surveilled, we might be investigated them. So this is not a program that goes instead of the other things we do. It comes along with the other things we do to support the investigation, the surveillance, and so on.
Well, let's just set the scene a bit and go through the process. This is primarily in this neighbourhood called the Brabant neighbourhood in your city of Aarhus, which is the second largest in Denmark, which I gather has a lot of different nationalities, 80 nationalities, and it's sort of split. There's a middle-class neighbourhood on one side, and then over the road there's this very complex neighbourhood where you've got this Salafist, which is a very conservative form of Islam, Salafist mosque. Now, did you have a problem with the young men being attracted to that particular mosque?
Yes, we did. When we saw this problem about young men traveling to Syria in the end of 2012, we tried to find out why are these young men going to Syria, who recruits them and what goes on. And after we had worked with that problem for more than a year, we could see that 27 persons had left to go to Syria from the city of Aarhus. And we also could see that 22 of these persons, they had attended that specific mosque. So we thought very carefully about it. What can we do about these things? It is not illegal to go to Syria, and how can we stop that traffic? So we decided to publish the facts and confirm to the press that we could see that that specific mosque was a problem. We also contacted the mosque and asked them, well, we see this as a problem. If you do the same, we would like to meet with you and discuss what could be done about it.
And what was the response from the people at the mosque?
Well, in the beginning, they said, well, what you see is not correct. This is a large mosque. We have a lot of young Muslims in this mosque, and what you say is not correct. But after we had tried to convince them that what we saw and the numbers we gave them was correct, They accepted the fact that they would like to meet with us and discuss with the police and the municipality what could be done to stop the traffic. And that is what happened in January of 2014. We began to have regular meetings with the board of the mosque.
And since the program started in earnest, I understand only one man has left to join the war. So that's quite a significant change, isn't it?
These figures, you say one man, that's a little too little. Since January 2015, we have seen four persons from this area going to Syria, two men and two women.
Are there patterns that you've come to see in the lives of these young people? Because there's quite a phenomenon of father absence in quite a few of the situations in Australia. I just wondered whether they're particularly poor families or not. Are they particularly wealthy families? What do you see?
Well, mostly I could say these. What goes along with all of these cases is that these young men, they are Muslims. They are strong believers, so to speak.
Right.
And some of them, only a very few of them, out of the 34 which we have here in the city of Aarhus, they are converts. The rest of them are young men or women from families that originally comes from the Middle East or from Northern Africa. And none of these young men has received their strong religious beliefs from their parents. And as you say, yes, some of them has no father figure. But most of these young men are, as a matter of fact, quite well educated. They are at high school and some of them at the university. So they're not the normal target group when you speak of young men going into a criminal career, for instance. These young men and women, they are quite different. Well, some of them are also from poor families. However, they are resourceful because, as a matter of fact, they have made a rational choice to go into this.
What do you mean?
So, well, if you are not resourceful and if you have a number of problems in your daily life of any kind, it's not possible for you to go into a radicalization process because they need resources to make that rational choice to go into these things. I have met many of these young men, and as a matter of fact, they are quite clever young men.
Right.
And it is very surprising for us to see the fact that these young men, they could be very integrated because they speak Danish fluently. They speak Danish, Arab, Turk, and so on. They are quite resourceful, most of them.
So you've actually developed quite a lot of a certain respect for them, by the sound of it?
Well, respect and also quite curious about why are they not integrated into Danish society. I couldn't say why, but I can see that if we try to reintegrate them, try to invite them to come into the society and have an education and continue with their education and so on, some of them, as a matter of fact, say, yes, we would like to do that. But we are quite surprised by the fact that we can see why are these young men not very good integrated into Danish society, because they have an opportunity to be that, but they have chosen not to be.
I'll just tell the listeners, Superintendent Alan Arslev, I'm delighted, is joining us with the East Jutland Police from Denmark, talking about the very successful anti-radicalisation program that they're developing. So just take us through the process then, meeting the men, assigning mentors to them, recruiting the mentors. Can you talk us through that, please?
Well, when you speak of our mentors, well, that is the most important issue we have here in this program. It is the fact that the persons who need support, we try to offer them a mentor. And we recruit mentors from all over the Danish society and all over the city with their different nationalities and different backgrounds, and we give them a small education. But what is most important about our mentors is the fact they want to make a difference. They want to go into our mentor program and they want to help a young man or women with their normal and daily life. So when we see a young person somewhere in a radicalization process, we try to connect to them and interview them. And if we can see they have problems in their daily life, we offer them a mentor.
What sort of problems might they demonstrate that would alert you to them?
Well, first of all, it can be very difficult to assess whether these persons tell us their full story or only part of their story, or if their story perhaps is more or less false. It is not compulsory to come into our office because we are not going to charge them with anything. We invite them to go into our office because we have a concern for them with the municipality. And as a matter of fact, all of these young men come to our office. So we have an interview, talk with them for an hour and a half. And that's, as a matter of fact, the most important way for us to see what kind of situation they're in.
Am I correct in saying that there's a principle of early recognition, cordiality and integration as a sort of motifs that underlie your approach? Is that right?
That's a correct summary, but it is also a very short and brief summary because these problems and what we see when we approach these young men, they are in quite different situations. We can see that some of them who has returned from Syria, for instance, they're quite disillusioned about what they have experienced in Syria. Any kind of radicalization or extremism has disappeared totally and just won't help to get their normal life back. But we can also see some other persons who are radicals as we see them and who does not want any kind of help to get reintegrated. We are not sure that they are a security problem to the Danish society, but of course, when we see a person with that kind of background, we, of course, work together with the Danish Intelligence Service to make sure that the right initiatives are taken according to these persons. However, the persons we have in this target group, they are quite different. They have different backgrounds and they have different stories.
This very important 90-minute interview where they come in voluntarily, do you always have a cleric from the mosque there sitting with you? Is it important to have a religious leader involved or not?
Not. No, this is a very personal interview, and the only persons present is the young man, a woman himself, and the police, and sometimes the municipality. That depends on how old the person we interview is.
How interesting. Have you learned a lot, as it were, about the business of helping these resourceful young men whom you're describing really feel they've got a stake in modern Western society?
Well, one of the lessons we have learned is the fact that we can see that some of these young men, and I don't know if it is only a feeling or if it goes on for real, but they feel discriminated, and that is what they tell us. They do not feel a part of the Danish society. That is one of the lessons we have learned, that these young men, they are connected to each other in small groups with strong social bonds, and they keep each other closely into that radical interpretation of Islam, which is necessary if you attend that specific mosque. And they support each other to go to Syria.
So how do you personally, Superintendent, how do you persuade them that they are welcome in your society?
The way we do it is we try to be honest. And when we say we would like to help them, we also say, well, if we can prove that you have committed crimes, of course, we are the police and we would prosecute you. However, if you need help, we have a close connection to the municipality, but the kind of help they get is not any different to the kind of help any other citizen would get if they had problems. Well, if they had no place to live, we could help them with that. If they are not a part of the education system when they are 20 years old, we could help them into the education system. If they need a psychologist, perhaps we could help them to see a psychologist. Mm-hmm. And when they have seen that they honestly can get help, they get more confident with what goes on in the Danish society, and they are quite open when we speak to them about the problems they have and what kind of help they need.
Sounds like a massive sort of modern form of social work. Look, Superintendent, congratulations, and I think there'll be a great deal of interest here in Australia. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
I'm Geraldine Doogue. I do hope you can join me at the same time next week or online via the RN website.